The Guardian.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen, sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club. I'm Claire Armistead, books editor of The Guardian and Observer. This month's guest is Susan Hill. In over 50 years of writing, Susan has turned her hand to short stories, to crime fiction, to non-fiction, and to children's novels. But it's the supernatural tale, The Woman in Black, published way back in 1983, which has had the most lasting impact on her career. The novel was turned into a play in 1987 and continues to run in the West End. It's just been made into a cinema blockbuster starring Harry Potter star Daniel Radcliffe. John Mullen began by asking Susan about her own love for the ghost story genre.
I dug up a quote, which is a kind of compliment to you, actually, Susan, for the success of The Woman in Black, from a famous scholar, an extremely odd man called Montagu Summers. I don't know if you've come across him. Well, he was a famous scholar of 17th century drama, but also one of the first scholars of Victorian ghost fiction. And he says about ghost stories, setting aside the highest masterpieces of literature, i.e. sort of Shakespeare, there's nothing more difficult to achieve than a first-class ghost story. I'm sort of presuming, Susan, that in order to write The Woman in Black, you yourself have to be a sort of fan of ghost stories or of 19th century ghost stories, perhaps.
I think it would be very difficult not to be. I think if you were not a fan and you hadn't read a lot of them, I really don't see how you could write one. And you're right to add of 19th century, and I would sort of include early 20th century, because it is a very specific genre. And if you didn't like it, as a lot of people don't, I mean, it's just like a lot of people don't like science fiction. I don't. You find it doesn't mean very much to them. I would never attempt to write a science fiction novel because I not only am unsympathetic towards it, but I've never read any really much. I mean, I've read odd books. So I wouldn't begin to write one. I don't remember when I first read ghost stories. You know, all children tell each other ghost stories or there are ghost stories around. But quite when I started to read them, I don't remember. But I suppose it was probably A Christmas Carol, because that's in all our sort of psyches every Christmas, and it certainly was, you know, in mine. In my childhood, particularly with Dickens, and it still is, I think that was very possibly the first one, and not actually a very typical ghost story. But I know that when
I... Because it's quite funny, isn't it?
It's funny, it's totally seasonal, it's a moral tale, it's got all sorts of other aspects. And, you know, when Marley appears, the ghost of Jacob Marley, he isn't a ghost. Well, he's a ghost, but he looks just like Marley in life, and there's nothing sort of ghostly about it. It's when the phantoms of Christmas past and future turn up that we get the frisson, and then the real alarm sets in, and it becomes very dark. People think it's jolly, and so it is. But then it becomes very dark. But I think this is what appealed to me when I started to read them, that there is something both entertaining in the right sense, popular in the right sense. People enjoy it. People like being frightened in a safe situation. They like to make themselves a bit frightened. There's all of that. But then there has to be, for me anyway, a serious side. And a dark side, because it really is about the good, bad, dark, light, good, evil battle. It's about the endless battle. Or it has to be to me, anyway.
One striking thing about The Woman in Black is that it's quite a long time before you get to what some people might say is the real story. And this is a kind of common thing, I think, in 19th century stories. In one of my columns I wrote about The Woman in Black, I took the very well-known example of the turn of the screw, because I thought people would have come across that. But it's really, really common that before you get to the story, you get somebody telling you that they've got a story. Yeah.
It's the traditional framework. Why do you need
in the case of the woman in black, why do you need that frame narrative all about him? I mean, there's all sorts of stuff about him. He buys how he first came to see the house that he's living in, his stepchildren telling jocular stories. Why is that important?
I wonder this myself because I've done it several times again. I did it in a ghost story called The Man in the Picture. I've used it in The Small Hand, another one. It is the traditional device. I think it's partly that it does provide an entree into the story. I don't think a ghost story can go bang, as a thriller can, as a crime novel can, straight in there with a ghost on paragraph one, because you have to build up, lead up slowly. People know that something is going to happen, and they are prepared to let you take your time to make them feel uneasy. And the best way of doing that is to start in a very relaxed way. You know, the screw is completely loose and you're saying, well, I've got a story and you may not believe this and I don't like to remember it much now, but I think I need to tell it to get it out of myself, as we all say. You know, I need to tell this to sort of get rid of it, because it's a cathartic thing. And gradually the person relaxes. And I think this is what the Victorians did. You know, people read because they didn't have other forms of entertainment. They read a lot, and they didn't necessarily want it to rush through. They didn't want bang, 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 straight in there. I mean, it's slow, it's like slow food, I suppose. It's slow reading. And people settle back, even with a short story, and they think, this is the man, he's got a story to tell, I'm prepared to go along with him. But gradually, the screw tightens, and it's the perfect title, that, because it is exactly this. And then you have to slightly relax the screw a little bit. You don't go on like that. And I think this is where, you know, I get a lot of people asking me what are the rules of writing? They all want to be writers. What are the rules? Now, I always say there are no rules, because essentially I think that's true. But in certain genres, there have got to be some rules. If you're very, very, very bold and dispense with all the rules, you may be lucky. But I like to keep that security for the reader and for me of those conventions. They're not necessarily rules, but they're conventions which are recognised as soon as people pick up this sort of ghost story.
Is there also a sense that you get from these frame narratives and ghost stories that, you know, a ghost is always somebody coming or something coming back from the past, isn't it? And that if you have one of these frame narratives, that's what you're sort of doing in the narrative, because the person who's telling the story, in this case, Arthur Kipps, as you were saying, there's quite a lot in the opening chapters about him saying, him intimating that something has happened to him in the past, which he finds unpleasant to remember but difficult to forget. Yeah. And that's sort of in a psychological way what the ghost is.
I mean, it's like a set of mirrors, really, isn't it? You look in the first one and then you see the reflection both past and, you know, you're going deeper into the story, and by going deeper into the story, you're actually brought into the present. You start in the past and you come into the present, if you like. Kipps is present. When he starts telling the story, it's over, it's done, he's an older man. He's happy and comfortable and he thinks it's all finished. And then you go with him back into the past, but that past becomes the present. It's a lovely device to use because it gives you a very secure structure. I discovered this, that if I start to write another ghost story, and I'm being a bit careful not to write too many, but if I do start, I know that I've got this to use if I want to. On the other hand, you can't lean on it as a crutch. You've got to make that device be there, but it's your prop and the reader's prop. If the device becomes all, then, you know, or if it becomes the prop for a bad story.
And what about talking about the past, I realised when I reread The Woman in Black, we were talking about it as a sort of Victorian ghost story, and I was wondering to myself, now, when is this story set? What is the setting? And there's people in ponies and traps, but there's people in cars as well.
Well, there's gas lamps,
and then there's sort of rather sort of mischievous, it seemed to me, on the second reading, stuff in which the narrator says, oh, the biggest business was beginning to sound just like something from a Victorian novel. I mean, is it deliberately uncertain?
Yes, it's set in what my editor at my publisher calls Hill Time, which is, you know, I've invented. It's not Victorian.
No.
I mean, I'm uncertain, but I think it's somewhere between 1918, because the First World War is over. I'm quite sure that that's done with, right. And we, you know, 1918 and 1925, something like that. It could be the turn of the century. There are steam trains, there are cars, there are gas lamps, but probably there's the very beginning of, you know, electric light as well. I mean, it's on that cusp of when everything accelerated and hurtled towards now. But it doesn't really matter. And I deliberately, almost always deliberately fudge time, because I don't want people to... It's not a historical novel. I mean, as I quite often get an email saying, but they hadn't discovered the motor car then. And I always reply, I hadn't discovered the motor car when.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I know either.
But that's a peculiar thing. I mean, I had taken, by the way, a vow, which I'm going to obey, to not to talk about the film or stage adaptations, or not to ask Susan about these. You're welcome to after I finish. But it does seem to me, without talking, we mustn't talk about the film. I can imagine when you were, if you were to make an adaptation of this, Hill Time presents you with some really tricky problems, doesn't it? Because, of course, it's as if when you go into the conventions of a ghost story, you're reading, that's all fine. It's all absolutely fine. And the calculations, which you could do, hang on, this happened to him 30 years earlier. So if he's now, so where is he now? That must be, he must be in the 1940s. No, but none of that matters,
no,
does it,
doesn't.
When you're reading.
It really doesn't.
But it's
no.
tricky. It would be tricky if you were to want to adapt it, wouldn't you?
You'd have to settle for
something. Because you have to work out what the lights are and, you know. And,
oh, yeah, you have to then be much more... specific.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that's the sort of thing about ghost stories, that you sort of suspend disbelief in a sense about setting as well as about the natural and the probable
when
you
enter that? I'd be much more specific about setting, though, because I think that, I mean, I know there are places that make one feel that they might be haunted. Yes. Should we put it like that? They make you either feel uncomfortable or slightly uneasy, and then this occurs to you. The places are terribly important. They're not real specific places. I didn't have a place in mind with Crithin.
No, you're very indeterminate, aren't
it's
you?
And obvious,
in fact, if one was dead, to be pedantic, which of course I try to avoid being, but he goes to Crewe, doesn't he?
Yes.
But he ends up on the East Coast. And
yeah, because it is undoubtedly the East Coast. I think probably somebody has written a PhD about the significance of Crewe in the story.
You don't mean that I have fellow pedants?
Yeah, you do. It was just a silly mistake, you know. I mean, I should know better, for goodness sake. I've been on the East Coast enough. I was born there. And I've been through Crewe Station. And you just kind of... and it stayed there. And it's one of those mistakes that we've never kind of corrected. And now it's gone into mythology, and we never will, I'm sure. In any edition, it's always going to be Crewe. But it has no particular significance at all. Just slightly,
And the setting is also kind of quite important in the story because, well, it's very important. But one peculiar thing about the setting, which you wouldn't necessarily expect, is that this place, this remote, strange place, is also something that the narrator feels sort of attracted to. So he spends quite a lot of time saying how lovely it is and how sort of strangely beautiful he finds this kind of remote and...
Well, I think, I mean, those parts of England, and the East Coast is, because it's my coast, and I just, the light is so beautiful, the whole atmosphere of the East Coast is totally different from the West Coast. I mean, you don't get so much rain, just simple things like that, which changes the light. You don't get the moisture in the atmosphere, so you get a drier light. There's something about the East Coast which has this sort of feeling, if you love it, you love it. When you go to any of those East Coast places with marshes or beaches or whatever, and especially in the right light, they are beautiful. And when he first goes there, it's beautiful weather, sunshine, lovely light, and he has no reason to suppose anything other than, oh, what a wonderful place. It's only as it gradually creeps in. And if you were to adapt this for any other medium, you would concentrate at first on how beautiful, wherever it is you have chosen for this place, how beautiful it can look. And indeed does.
I suppose one thing which is common but not universal amongst 19th century ghost stories. I mean, there's a wonderful, actually, anybody who's interested in this, there's a terrific Oxford anthology of Victorian ghost stories. The majority of them are first person, by no means all, but the majority of them are first person.
Yeah.
I mean, was that a kind of absolutely sort of natural choice for you?
Yes, it very much was, and I think that's partly because of having read a lot of them. Usually I just let the tense tell me the way to go. If I'm starting a book, there's a sort of moment of choice, and it just is natural to tell that particular book in the first person or not. Now, I can't imagine writing a ghost story not in the first person.
Why is that?
I don't know, because it almost feels like putting on the wrong size shoe. It just feels wrong. Whereas other stories, I can think, yeah, I could have told that in, you know, the other way.
I mean, there are some good... I mean, M.R. James wrote some...
He certainly did. Oh, absolutely. It doesn't have to be. I just feel it's right. But I have a feeling, because I know I always like to do something new and challenge myself. I want to try it. I mean, this is the very reason that I wrote The Woman in Black, because apart from The Turn of the Screw, I think, and then those other early gothic novels, which are not ghost stories at all. I didn't know a full-length one. I know you say novel, novella, it's on the cusp, but I mean, this is not a short story.
No.
Turn of the Screw is not really a short story. I wanted to challenge myself because it's much easier to write at a short length than a ghost story, because you've got, you know, the start, you build up the tension, the denouement, and you don't have to worry about what shall I do with chapters, let's say, 5 to 11, which have got to kind of... They're not got to be filling. They must not be the filling in the sandwich, but they're there. I've got to do something to make the reader keep on reading, to keep the tension going. And that was a real challenge. And I think that I'd love, perhaps, to challenge myself to do a ghost story in the third person.
Yeah,
see if I can do it.
I mean, the shortness thing you mentioned is, I've always assumed it was partly respecting that 19th century convention which you sort of depict in the frame narrative of a ghost story being something that people perform at the fireside sort of thing.
Yeah.
But also, presumably, I always assumed that it was to do with the ghost story being the form which absolutely cannot sort of brook interruption.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You have to...
Can't brook interruption
it,
and it can't brook long girls.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, isn't it no good having a long...
And The Woman in Black, I mean, I certainly, when I first read it, I'm sure I read it in one... I think I read it in one go.
Yeah, it should... Ideally, this is why there is a play. I mean, I know we're not talking about the play, but in fact, the play plays without an interval. And that's absolutely right, because you really, and ideally. And I think something like The Turn of the Screw, I certainly read that in one go. And actually, this is something that I'm going to sort of tell you, that I've been answering questions about how The Woman in Black came about over the last month, you know, just endlessly. And I've never actually... I thought I'd save it for you, John, and save it for here. I've never actually said the one thing that I know was probably the real trigger. Apart from, I mean, those were triggers, obviously, reading ghost stories, liking them, wanting to do it, wanting slightly to have a bit of a revival of it. Let's see if people will want to read a long one again. Everybody's influenced by somebody, and I've obviously been influenced by a great many writers, you know, Hardy, Dickens, Graham Greene, but I think the person who had most influence over my writing fully and completely was a composer, Benjamin Britten. He was one of the world's most literary composers. He read a huge amount and, of course, wrote operas and song cycles based on literature. He didn't, on the whole, like just to have sounds. His was very much words and music together. Now, I knew Ben a little, and we talked one day about... He was writing the first opera ever, I think probably the last, ever written for television, which was a Henry James ghost story called Owen Wingrave, which he adapted, he wrote as an opera, specifically for television. And I'd never read Owen Wingrave, I hadn't heard of it. And he said, no, you must read it, you must read Henry James ghost stories. I'd read The Turn of the Screw, and I thought that was all. And he said, because these are great literature, they're also very good ghost stories, and the two can combine, because this was at a time when people thought, oh, ghost stories, schlock, you know, pulp fiction, horrors. And Ben said, no, some of the greatest writers have written ghost stories, and Henry James par excellence. And he lent me his volume 9 of the Henry James short stories, of Henry James ghost stories, in which Owen Wingrave is. And he said, there are lots of others, you know, but this is the one. And I just felt this was something that I knew was great literature and also, as he said, you know, a damn good story, and that the genre, like the ghost story, could actually be good literature. And from then I went on to read more of Henry James' ghost stories, and they are terrific. I mean, he's got there's some very good ones. They're all short, apart from Turn of the Screw, which is sort of medium. And I owe my interest in the ghost story going on and really pushing me towards writing one to Ben Britton, as I owe so many other things, because it was an obsession of his, and I picked that one up. I mean, lots of other of his obsessions became mine, like the First World War and so on, but that's really one of the places where it began.
I mean, why do you think Henry James has such a thing for ghosts?
Well, Henry James was a bit of the era when, you know, people were a bit, had psychic beliefs and so on. I mean, Henry James is par excellence about people and character, and he just felt that he could put his sort of messages and characters and things he wanted to say about the human condition into this form. They're not the obvious Victorian ghost story, no. Of course. And Owen Wingrave's a magnificent story, but it isn't by any means like one of the Victorian
stories. It's funny, actually, staying on this sort of thing of the narrator of your story. One of the things about Henry James' ghost stories is that he always said about novels that he abhorred first-person narrative.
Yeah.
But with ghost stories, much shorter and sort of belonging within a particular genre, of course he felt free to use it. Yeah. I mean, the Turn of the Screw is the most famous example. And it's kind of, I wonder if he wasn't a bit on holiday from some of his own rules.
Yeah, maybe. And I mean, although M.R. James, no relation. Yes. I mean, M.R. James and the ghost stories of the antiquary were always told, you know, these were light-hearted stories, ghost stories at Christmas. He told them to the boys at Eton, sort of sitting around the fire. This was all just kind of jolly good fun. Well, yes, so it is, but there is a great darkness in those stories because they're not just about ghosts, they are about evil. If you read the ghost stories of an antiquary, I mean, they're wonderful stories, but there's something very dark, and it's not usually, or not always, just ghostly figures of human beings who were dead and are coming back. It's evil things, sometimes indescribable, things from hell, you know, that are like out of a Bosch painting. Mm-hmm. And there was something very, very dark deep down. I don't think it matters that we analyse it. Better not, actually, like all these things, you know, better not to know why M.R. James had this thing about this sort of evil, because it turned into magnificent stories. But they're not true ghost stories in my book.
Why is that?
Because they're so often not just ghosts, and they're not, you know, my definition of a ghost is something that is seen by people who are now living, or a person who is now living, which was known to have once been alive, was known to have died, and is seen again, in either in the same form or in a ghostly form, whatever that may mean. It could be an animal, but it certainly isn't a sort of hideous thing coming out of a trunk in an old vestry, which has, I mean, there's a dreadful image in one of the M.R. James stories about the man putting his hand under the pillow and finding this dreadful thing which was the size of a sort of small ball, but had a hair and teeth. And it's, you know, and this wonderful story, A Whistle and I'll Come to You, which is, I pinched one of the title for one of those chapters. You know, it's not a ghost that we know it. It's a figure of a face of crumpled linen, which haunts you every time you change the bed sheets. So he was different, and I think he took it in a slightly different direction. It's not a direction I want to go in.
Your ghost, one of the crucial things about it is that it's not just the narrator who sees it, is it? I mean, that's a...
No.
I mean, and that was kind of... Was that a decision that you had to make? Because you could divide ghost stories into those ones where it could all be in the mind of the narrator.
Yeah. Mm.
Or it couldn't. And yours is the latter, isn't it?
This is very much the latter, because so many people see her. And, of course, the defining thing is that something happens when after they've seen her. I mean, usually ghosts actually don't have any effect. You know, they just are there. And there are, as I've often said, what is the point of a pointless ghost? It does not make a good story. You know, somebody goes to a particular castle and sees a veiled lady drift up a staircase. And then somebody else goes and see her do that. And 10 years later, the same. Well, and I mean, there's no story, is there? It doesn't prove anything. She hasn't got a point. She doesn't say anything or do anything. People go home and that's that. In fiction and literature particularly, of course, it's got to have a reason. Otherwise, it's neither here nor there. That's why, ultimately, all those sort of true ghost stories are rather boring.
Yeah. I suppose the true ghost stories, the often the structure of a true ghost story, which you sometimes get in 19th century ghost stories, is somebody says something peculiar that they've experienced, and then they later find out some narrative about something that once happened.
Yeah, that's fine. Goes, well, that's a story kind of going the other way, isn't it? Yeah. That sort of backward story.
And I mean, in a way, you get that in The Woman in Black as well, in that one of the conventions that you obey about ghost stories is that the narrator, although the narrator knows everything, when he tells a story, knows everything, his younger self goes off to a place where things have happened and other people know, and his employer sort of knows something, although...
Yeah. It never quite says, no.
Yeah, so there's all that bit chill about children. Did she have children?
Yeah.
No.
People have determined not to tell him, and yet the hints that are dropped or the warnings that are given gradually combine, not just to make us feel uneasy, but of course to make him feel uneasy. And at that moment, he starts saying, "Oh, ridiculous, I didn't believe any of this. I'm going to sort of go over there and it's all going to be fine. And I'm going to go through these papers." And you know, I mean, this is the moment when you know that he doesn't yet know that, and so on.
Yeah, well, that's itself is another kind of a convention of Victorian ghost narratives, isn't it? That the narrator is a... or the main character, sometimes it's in third-person stories as well, is a sceptic or a disbeliever.
Oh, yeah,
no.
Absolutely.
They can't start off, can they, as a kind of superstitious person?
No, they have to be transformed by
their experiences.
Yes, this is a real convention. And I think there's a wonderful ghost story, which is set, a contemporary ghost story, a short one by A.S. Byatt called The July Ghost, which is a magnificent, magnificent story. And it's about... A.S. Byatt, I don't know if you know, had a son who was killed when he was 12, Charles. Now, the story is about a woman who lives in a North London house. It's in the summer, July. She has a lovely garden, and she takes... We don't know that she's had a son, but she takes a young lodger because she's got a spare bedroom. So she takes a student in. And one day he's sitting at his window working, I think. I can't remember the exact detail. And he sees a boy in the garden, a 12-year-old boy, and you know, thinks... Oh, right, I didn't know she'd, you know... And the boy seems to be at home and so on. And he says to her when she next sees him, "You know, who's the boy I saw in the garden?" And, of course, she never sees the boy. The student is the only one who sees him. And I think he even talks to him, but he certainly sees him. And the saddest... It's an incredibly sad story, and, of course, made much more so when you know what it's based on, the true story behind it. Because she keeps saying to him, "You've got to call me when he's there. I must see that boy." There is nothing frightening about this at all. This is just dreadfully poignant and sad. And that's a perfect example of a ghost story that can, A, work in a contemporary setting, and B, is a ghost story but not. You know, it's not this sort of thing. And it's certainly not an entertainment.
There's something sad, too, about your story, isn't there? I mean, it's quite important that although the ghost... Janet has become this terrible, malign force, that the narrator, Arthur, of the story, when he's in that house, especially when he's in the nursery, feels something sad as much as something frightening.
Yeah. Well, this is why, you know, the best ghost stories, this is very hard to define, but the ones that interest me most and move me most, and the ones that I think I will always write, have got a child in them somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a wonderful ghost story by Kipling called They, about children in a garden. Somebody sees some children playing in a garden and they don't really exist. Children being around, I mean, my ghost story called The Small Hand is about a boy whose hand suddenly goes into a man, feels a hand taking hold of his and looks down to see where the child is.
Yes.
And is not there. And, of course, you know, Jeanette is grieving, but she cannot let go of also this desire for revenge. So it's the balance of, you know, she'd have had therapy now, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Well, there was a blogger, that gives me a perfect cue, who said if only she'd had a visit from a grief counsellor. I hasten to say this was a blogger who enjoyed all this unpleasantness.
Good.
But now, we're allowed, as you know, as we've said, and I hope everybody here is kind of happy about this, we're allowed to talk about the endings of the book, because we've all read it, you know,
course,
we're allowed the spoilers. And there were actually a couple of bloggers to the website who so worried about the ending in a particular way, and it would be, the Guardian love blogs and things, you know, so they love me to sort of speak for the blogosphere and put this to you, that a couple of readers didn't exactly complain because they were clearly really addicted to the story, but they worried about the sort of narrative logic, I suppose, of the ending, in that what has happened to Arthur, which is implicit actually from the very beginning, once you, you know, second time round, you certainly realise it. He's acquired this step family, but he mentions this woman he was going to get married to. What happens right at the end, and the one moment of real violence in the whole story, the bloggers said, or a couple of the bloggers said, poor old Arthur, what's the logic of her malignity? But he's just turned up to sort through a few papers. And he's just an outsider. He's got nothing to do with this terrible thing that's happened to her. And yet she revenges herself upon him.
The whole thing is about anybody who sees her. And generally, the only people who see her are not just people who might walk through the village or anything, are always people with children. And somebody who goes to dig up the past, disturb the place, has no business there, but goes to invade. And the moment he sees her, also, he, you don't know whether the first time, you know, she's got a message for him or whatever, but she wants to show herself to him, because a terrible thing to say. You could say, well, she's looking for somebody else with a child too, because this cycle is endless for her. And she's almost, you know, I've got to find somebody else who's has a child to see me to, you know, try and take my revenge on. It's almost like somebody, constant emotional pain. She's trying to find a way to stop this pain, and it never does. And, you know, it may be a fudge of an ending. You know,
don't say that.
Endings do get
your ending.
I mean, I'm the first one to, you know, my entire writing life has been an attempt to disguise the fact that I can't plot. And you know, logically, I'm open to everybody saying, ah, yes, but you see, he wouldn't have done that if so and so. And I think, oh no, oh dear. You know? So if people find it less than watertight, I plead guilty, except that I quite like unwatertight endings.
I think it's a good, the point of an ending is that in a way it should be implicit in the beginning, I always think.
Yeah, and it certainly is in that case, yeah.
I mean, I'll give everybody else a chance now, but I just wonder, I mean, I said at the beginning that I hope to find out, talking a bit about this, why ghost stories were so appealing. And I just wondered, I mean, thinking about your own ghost story in particular, what you think about, not why ghost stories might be frightening or disturbing, and that's quite often what people talk and write about, why ghost stories perturb us. But no, why ghost stories delight and please us.
What do you think about that? I think it's the need to be frightened safely. I've thought about this an awful lot. And being afraid, it's sort of being frightened delightfully, if you like. Mm. Being afraid in a genuinely dangerous or terrifying situation is not something you want anybody to experience. It is open-ended, a sort of naked fear is a dreadful thing. But all of us go from the day of our birth are in situations where we may be afraid. We have to learn to deal with it. Children have to learn to deal with it. We all have to learn to deal with it. Like all the other emotions and things that happen. And I think there's a sort of practice for the real thing. If you read a ghost story in a safe situation, you know, the curtains are drawn, the door is closed, there's a roaring fire, you're feeling very comfortable in a chair, and there's somebody else in the house and the doors are locked, so you can allow yourself to be frightened. You don't want to have the same thing if you're walking down a street on your own late at night and you have been told that the police are looking for somebody with, you know, a particular kind of footstep. You know, that's an unsafe situation. You don't want it. I think we need this. I don't know why. I mean, it's why ghost stories are absolutely universal in cultures around the world. I dare say they told them by the sort of primeval fires that there's a need to be able to deal with the shadows, with the darkness, with what might come out of them, and with our reaction to it. And we practice, you know, and we love to be frightened. Like, I mean, why do all these sort of, young people doing this book for A-levels, you know, write to me saying, oh, it was scary, and you know they loved it. I think we have to, it's like we need to laugh. We need to be made to laugh. You know, it's a physiological fact that we need to be made to laugh. And I suspect that being controllably frightened in a safe situation, and then we can enjoy, you know, the whole thing. Also, I think it's, who is it? Somebody said recently, and I can't remember where I heard it, that, but it must have been that somebody wrote it. You know, the ghost story is the ultimate piece of optimism, because it's implying that, of course, there's an afterlife. It may not always be wonderful, but it is the ultimately optimistic thing. So I think it's, I think it's all of those things.
Let's see if we've got any other theories. Anybody who has their own questions or indeed theories, please.
Hi, I was. I have to admit, I was worried about the film, having loved the book so much, but I want to say that the film does it fantastic justice. However, I wondered if you could explain perhaps a few of the changes that have been made without giving it away for people who haven't yet seen it. How involved were you creatively with the plot, and also why the big change at the end, which is so satisfying in the book?
Now, I wasn't involved at all, not at all, and I would never be, because various reasons. I'm not a film person, I'm not a screenwriter, and I feel very strongly that if you want somebody else, if you want somebody to make a film of a book of yours, as make a play of it, you let it go and you hand it over to them, because you are not, they are not making a carbon copy of your book and sticking it up on the stage or the screen. It's a reinterpretation in their eyes, in their imaginations, with their skills, for a different medium. And, you know, Ian McEwan said it all, really, which is you either take the cash or you take control, which is absolutely true. And I am so sick of hearing authors whinge, you know, in this precious way about, oh, they spoiled my book. Well, OK, don't, you know, it is going to be changed. It is not going to be the same. If you don't want that to happen, don't sell it. But also, the other thing is, I don't know who it was talking, so I can sort of say this, somebody saying, you know, Hollywood killed my book. No, they didn't. Your book's still there. You know, people don't have to go and see the film. The book will never be taken away. I know I'm digressing, but it's so obvious to me that, you know, it's fine if you do it. You hand it over to somebody. I didn't have anything to do with it. But I was told who the screenwriter would be, and I thought, I knew something of her work and thought, this is a very good idea. But until I read the screenplay, I had absolutely nothing to do with it. And then I met with Jane Goldman after I'd read the screenplay and thought it was absolutely terrific, because the one thing she does is retain the spirit of the story and the setting. But she retains the spirit of the Woman in Black is there. The fact that it's different in certain respects is her interpretation. The ending, I have to tell you, I don't like it very much, but it caused them no end of problems. That ending, I think, was redone half a dozen times until they couldn't do it anymore because they ran out of money. But it's not what I would have done, but then I didn't do it, you know. But I think the whole film is absolutely magnificent, so I it's a small quibble. But I gave it over to them. I said, here you are. And if I don't like it, you know, this is still here. You remember there was a man, my husband told me, it sounds as though I'm very erudite, but I didn't know this, but my husband, who's a Shakespeare scholar, told me there was an 18th century theatrical chap called Nahum Tate, and he took King Lear, Shakespeare's King Lear, and he rewrote it and gave it a happy ending. And that's bad enough. It was put on with a happy ending. But, and the real scandal is that I don't know how he did it, but he somehow had power to remove and not to allow any production of Shakespeare's King Lear. So that effectively Shakespeare couldn't have said, oh, well, my play's still there. It wasn't. Nahum Tate managed to obliterate it, and it wasn't rediscovered for, John will know, he's a professor, but it wasn't rediscovered for a long time. Now that, you know, morally wrong.
Well, I think it's also the audiences preferred it with a happy ending, oddly
well,
enough.
Well, yeah.
And they also thought that reading a play and seeing a play were just different things. So,
yeah.
But anybody.
Have you actually seen a ghost yourself?
I'm always asked that. No. I think with ghosts, you do have to apply the principle of Occam's razor, which means that 99.9% of the ghost sightings have a rational explanation or an explanation. But I do retain my credulity, if you like, because I think there are... It only takes one, if you think about it. Only one of them has got to be actually true for the whole thing to be possible, the whole thing to be likely. And I think there are one or two that cannot be explained in any way by me anyway, you know, but sort of like tricks of light and so on, and even more different things than that. Now, I do, and I certainly believe in haunted places, and places which have that, you know, I think the church is sound and wise in having an exorcism ceremony still, because there are places which have an evil effect on people, an evil feeling, an evil sensation, whatever you like to call it. And there's no doubt that whether it's placebo effect or whatever, if people do have an exorcism, the whole place just becomes benign again. And, you know, you just get I get a frisson occasionally in places. I don't know why. But I've certainly never seen what you would call a ghost. No. I'm waiting.
Yes?
Hello.
Hello.
I studied The Woman in Black when I was at school, and now I'm teaching English in Switzerland. I decided to do it with my students. Well, I think I'd forgotten quite how terrified I was the first time, because developing my teaching materials, I've been terrified all over again. But I was just wondering, what is your experience of having written this book that's gone on to become such a widely read set text in various different contexts? Has it been something you've been pleased about, or has it been a bit strange?
No, it's not strange, and I always answer all the questions that come in with when I get sort of the emails that begin. There's one famous one that began, "Dear Miss Hill, I've just had to read your book. Thanks for ruining my life." but you oh, it's true. But I wrote back and said, well, look, you know, somebody's got to. I think that, I mean, that is actually literally true. If they're going to study books and analyse them in order to indicate that they've got critical skills and that they can absorb information and regurgitate it, and if they're going to study how literature, how a novel actually works, then they might as well do this as anything else. Because what I really hope, and I always say, is that you've had to do this in a particular way in class. You've had to read it and analyse it and go over it again and write exam questions on it. And I had to do the same with other books. And OK, it can be very tedious, but don't let this put you off reading for enjoyment and enrichment. If in 20 years' time you can bear to come back to this book and just read it as a book, you might find you enjoy it and you've forgotten all about that stuff. But meanwhile, you know, just do it, and July will soon come. But I don't, you know, I have no feelings. I just sometimes wish that maybe they were challenged a bit harder, that's all, and a bit more than, you know, The Woman in Black's a bit of an easy read. I think they should be a bit challenged a bit more.
We have had authors who've come to the book club who've said, not publicly, but to me afterwards, if only they'd make it a set book. Oh, if only they'd make it a set book. You're not on any of those panels, are you? Don't you?
Yeah, anyway. Everybody thinks it's a way to a fortune. It's not.
Please.
Are you a dog lover? Because you put spider through quite a lot. And
yes.
I just wanted to know, like, was that a conscious decision to use an animal as a device? Because the first night when Arthur's in the house, he sees the ghost, gets drunk, and, well, kind of gets a bit drunk, has some brandy, I think it was, yeah. And falls asleep. And once he has a spider in the house with him, I don't know if that allowed you some more interesting opportunities as a writer. In some ways, he feels responsible.
Yeah, it was actually Spider the dog was a useful thing, because it did change the tone of things. I mean, he feels safe when he's got Spider, which is why Mr. Daly has given him to him. You know, there's nothing like the presence of a dog in the house if you're on your own. It's a cat, or even a cat, but particularly a dog. I mean, yeah, I love dogs, and Spider's my sort of perfect little dog, and I've got a dog like Spider now, but she's not a chat.
But I mean, but, animals are often important in ghost stories, aren't they?
Oh, very, absolutely. Because... And animals, of course, have this extraordinary sixth sense, and that is without question. You know, why does an animal know that its owner is coming home sometimes, even when the owner hasn't left America or whatever? I mean, there is a very strange... Animals do undoubtedly have... I don't like the word psychic, but there's something that animals have that we do not.
We had Jan Martel here once. That Jan Martel geezer, we had him
Oh,
here.
Yeah, yeah.
And he explained like all that thing. Yep. He explained it's not supernatural at all. He explained exactly why dogs
okay,
know this.
Okay, all right.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
Rationalist.
I can't remember what the... Please.
I just wanted to ask, what type of books did you read as a child and how do they compare to the type of books you would read now?
Oh, I still sometimes read the books I read as a child. But I read Alice in Wonderland just over and over and over and over again. But I just became obsessed with Alice in Wonderland. I read that. I also read Dickens. I know I keep referring to Dickens, but when I was 9, I went to stay with my great aunt and she had a complete set of Dickens in a glass-fronted cabinet. And I was allowed to sort of open it and have a look. And she said, oh, I don't think you'll like any of those, but you know, you can read them. And I picked out one and started to read it. And I know that I couldn't possibly have understood it all, but nevertheless, there was enough there to keep me going. And I read Enid Blyton, and I will defend Enid Blyton.
Yeah,
because
right.
I went through Enid Blyton.
Hear it for Enid.
Yeah. I know it's bland. I know it's sort of like...
No, some of it's terrific. I think some of it's...
She's got a very bland style, and her vocabulary is not very extensive, but Enid Blyton was the only person until J.K. Rowling came along who actually got non-reading children to find books exciting and to read them and to rush out. And I went through Enid Blyton like an express train. But I read whatever was in the library, because remember, it was libraries then, and it still should be, but it was libraries because there were not the bookshops. We couldn't afford the new books anyway. And we had a children's library in Scarborough, an actual physical separate building. And I just went through it, really, indiscriminately, which is, I think, probably the best way.
I think I'm gonna bring down the guillotine.
Okay.
Because I think that Susan's been very generous with her energies, her thoughts, her time, and we must give her a glass of Rioja to thank her for coming and talking to us.
Thank you.
The Guardian Book Club with John Mullen is sponsored by David Stowe Cheddar. Cornish cheddars made with over 60 years of knowledge, time, and skill. To find out more, please visit davidstowecheddar.co.uk.